This is a talk which obviously involves both, it has a little bit of content and a lot of opinions, and there are three collaborators and they have three sets of opinions, and so you're getting mine. and so my apologies will be directed not so much to the audience as to my collaborators who may not hear, who may hear these statements that they're slightly uncomfortable with and not hear statements they wish they heard more of. So, you know, we have a long-standing question in string theory there, you know, that, you know, I think that Michael Douglas described for us very, very nicely yesterday, that we have sort of, I've always sort of thought we have too many vacua, and we can't see any selection principle for them, anything which would distinguish. And in fact, there really are sort of two broad categories of string vacua which are well distinguished. There are the vacua with more than four supersymmetries, okay, and these are, as far as we know, these are perfectly good states of some underlying quantum gravity theory, perturbatively and non-perturbatively. They're perfectly well behaved. They're the arena for all kinds of wonderful things we do with dualities and so on. And then there are all the things with four or less supersymmetries, and I'm thinking in four dimensions, so this is why I'm sort of doing the counting this way. And for these, one has inevitably potentials for moduli, tadpoles, either perturbative or non-perturbative for various fields, and so on. So there really are sort of these two broad classes of distinguished theories. And in fact, this first set, while in some sense they've been the most useful for theorists, are the most boring. But they're also the ones that we understand the best and the ones that look perfectly fine. And then there are these others. So why don't we live in a universe, first of all, with more than four supersymmetries? As I said, there's probably nothing wrong with these. And this probably, you know, even for those of us who are somewhat uncomfortable with the anthropic principle, it could well be that the answer here is some sort of very mild anthropic considerations rule these out. And maybe there are parts of the universe which have six dimensions or eight or something like that, but they're probably pretty boring places to live. They don't have stars, probably. They don't have inflation, things like that. Okay, so we probably don't want to live in those. Now, what about the n equals zero theories? Okay. Well, what do I mean, first of all, by n equals zero? We often talk in string theory about things with n equals one as if they're supersymmetric, and things with n equals zero if they're not. But again, generically, in the n equals one theories, supersymmetry is broken. So what's really the distinction? And the distinction I'll make is kind of awkward, but just what I mean by n equals zero, for example, is that there's no supersymmetry except in limits of the moduli space where there are the classical moduli space where there are infinite numbers of supersymmetries. Okay. Well, when people talk about these, they often say they're bad for various reasons. They say, well, they're one-loop tadpoles, but I would sort of say, so what? They're tachyons in parts of their moduli space typically, but again, sort of, so what? One thing that I'm kind of playing around a lot with when I get to come down here is Witten's decay to nothing. There seems something special to these. Okay. And perhaps that's an indication that there's something wrong with these, but it's certainly not in any way we understand decisive. Okay, but maybe eventually we'll find some undesirable features or some inconsistencies in these. But more generally, one thing I think we've come to appreciate recently, especially, for example, at this cosmology workshop, is that we don't know how to make sense of any string solution with four or less supersymmetries. Okay, so all of them, as I say, have some kind of potential on the moduli space. And so they're all cosmological, okay? We can't think of them as some sort of static solutions in general, okay? And typically they have some singularity, and if we look at some kind of cosmological configuration, like here's something where this is, say, the dilaton, and there's some potential maybe at one loop. You can imagine starting the system off with expanding boundary conditions and letting the universe expand for a while, then the field will roll back, okay? But then there was a singularity in the past, and alternatively, you could start with contracting boundary conditions, and then there's a singularity in the future. And one of the things we don't know how to do in string theory is we don't know how to resolve these cosmological singularities. Okay, so we really don't know how to treat such a problem. And I've come to sort of to the view that that might be a positive thing. That may be telling us that really, at some point, we have to, maybe when we'll find in string theory that not all singularities, for example, are resolved. But that's not something we really know much about now. Okay, so I'm going to turn now to the sort of dreaded anthropic principle and talk about that a little bit. Okay, so Linde was, I think, probably the first person to realize that once one has inflation, there's a sort of sensible way to think about the anthropic principle. Okay, you can imagine that the universe is somehow extremely large, much larger than what we see, and the fundamental parameters take different values in different parts of the universe. Okay, well, that's an interesting idea, okay, and lots of people had toyed with it. Okay, but one of the questions we'd like to ask is such a possibility implemented in any fundamental theory? If it's not, I would suggest not to worry about it. Okay, I think that we'll hear different points of view today on this subject, but I think the anthropic principle is really most interesting, and in fact, if you like, most threatening, if in a theory where there really is some sense in which it might be implemented. If there is some sort of sense in which one might implement the anthropic principle, then the question is, can one rule out such a theory, or can one use it to make predictions? And there are sort of two, I call them simple, actually I should say there are just two, I should have really said two classes of ideas for how we might implement the anthropic principle. One is the idea, an old idea that one has perhaps some extremely light scalar field. And the second one is this idea known as a discretum. And I actually think I give Joe and Raphael a lot of credit for this, and also credit for inventing the name. But to assess either of these ideas, you need some sort of fundamental theory like string theory. So let me talk first about this continuum. And I like to talk about this one because I think we can pretty much rule this one out. Okay, so what does this continuum require? This requires that there be some scalar, okay, with a mass less than the Hubble constant today, okay, and which varies over a range in field space. So I'm thinking of this as a canonical field. Varies over a range in field space that's enormous compared to the Planck mass. Okay, so that's what you need. And so one question you can ask is, does that happen in string or M theory? And the answer appears to be no. And I really want to put a star by this, because I think it would be nice to really make this as solid as possible. And various pieces of this are rough, and there might be loopholes. But first of all, what about just sort of ordinary scalar particles in string theory? Are they ever really, really light? And the answer is generically no. Generically, you're sort of the usual, if you sort of calculate potentials where you can calculate them, the scalar masses or their curvatures or whatever are basically what you might expect from sort of some simple dimensional analysis and symmetry considerations. Okay, so there's no big surprise there. String theory doesn't offer any miracles, okay, that might give such a light scalar in that way. What string theory does have is it has lots of periodic scalars, axion-like fields. And these might be candidates if their decay constants, okay, are huge compared to the Planck mass. So what you could ask is, are there such scalars in string theory whose decay constants are parametrically, maybe by powers of coupling or the radius or the size of some large dimension or something, which are large compared to the Planck mass? And the answer seems to be no. And I certainly can't quote a theorem for that, but it certainly seems just sort of searching that it's very hard to find scalars like this. Okay, now, as I mentioned, there are ideas for how such a thing might be achieved. And so there are various sorts of loopholes. Okay, and it'd be interesting to know whether there are examples or whether one can close these loopholes. Okay, now what about this discretum? Okay, well, Tom and Nathan Zeiberg and I proposed a number of years ago something called an irrational axion as a way to get such a discretum. Okay, and I think the good news is that at least that one doesn't seem to be realized in string theory. At least we never found an example. Okay, Busso and Polchinski, as we heard, as we were reminded several times yesterday, discussed discretum, the possibility of getting discretum from quantized fluxes. In the original form in which they proposed it, there were many questions, particularly, for example, about the stabilization of moduli. So some of us could sort of rest easy saying, well, maybe these states really weren't there. But then 6 months ago or so, KKLT, following earlier work, for example, of Giddings, Kattrow, and Polchinski, proposed a string theory realization of the discretium with, you know, in a rather detailed way, okay, in which they really suggested what the states were. And this was, I'd say, so now suddenly one's nightmares had sort of come true. There were now potentially vast number of states, okay, and if this picture is true, if there really are such a vast number of states, we might not have a choice. Sort of anthropics might not be sort of optional, but they might be inevitable. Okay, so let me remind you a little bit about how this flux discretum works, at least in the way I understand it, and some of the experts, since we have several of the authors here, they can correct me now we're in the discussion. But basic idea is you consider some class of compactifications of string theory. I'll think about 2B on an orientifold of Calabi-Yau, and call that X for definiteness. And then there are lots of possible quantized fluxes. Okay, so there are Ramond and Neveu-Schwartz fluxes. Okay, and in general, I'll call the number of possible fluxes B3. And B3 can, for example, for Calabi-Yaus, can be very large. Now, the fluxes are not, as Michael was mentioning yesterday, are not highly constrained. So, for example, in this case, there are some tadpole cancellation conditions, okay, which I've written here. That's one condition. Okay, so it's one condition on many fluxes. Okay, as Michael said, it's this number chi can be of order several. Okay, this number, so one can imagine that there are tens of hundreds of such states. Okay. Now, so far, this is rather similar to what Busseau and Polchinski said, but KKLT also included a proposal to stabilize the moduli. So, for example, Giddings, Kattrow, and Polchinski had discussed, again, type 2 orientifolds of Calabi-Yau near a conifold point Z. Okay, and their interest, I guess, was largely in trying to understand how you might get warped spaces, but it also is interesting from the point of view of how fluxes tend to stabilize moduli. So in that case, they worked out the superpotential. Okay, here's Z as a modulus which measures basically the distance from the conifold point. Okay, and they wrote this formula, okay, which involves the dilaton tau is, I've lost it here, but tau is essentially 1 over G. Okay, and Z again is this distance from the point. M and K are two of these quantized fluxes. So you should think of those as numbers like 5 or 10 or something like that. Okay, now this has a supersymmetric minimum, this superpotential, when dZw, this quantity here, this Kähler derivative of W, vanishes. And it's solved by Z of order Z of the form exponent minus 2 pi k over m gs. So if somehow gs is small or k over m more precisely is large, okay, this can be exponentially small. Okay, so Z in principle could be very small. Okay, the corresponding space you can show is highly warped. Okay, and the expectation value of the superpotential itself is exponentially small at this point. Now, these authors also went on and they said, look, we can add more fluxes and stabilize more moduli. And the example they worked out was the dilaton itself, this tau. Okay, and so they added some more fluxes, some k prime, okay, and they had they got a superpotential now of this form, okay, where f is something that's non-vanishing in general at z equals 0. Okay, so now you solve this equation, okay, and you can now solve not only for the z as you did before, okay, the z is still this exponentially small thing, but you can also solve for the dilaton. And again, now if you choose m and k prime appropriately, you can imagine getting a large tau or a small coupling. Okay. One thing to note, I'd like to stress here, because it's going to be important to us in a moment, the w naught, the expectation value of the superpotential in this case, is no longer particularly small. Okay. So in this particular model, in the limit that R is very large, there's no potential for R. Okay. And so the compactification radius is not fixed. Okay. So they went one step further and they asked, how could you fix the remaining moduli? Okay. So I should say that, first of all, by just adding more fluxes, one can, in principle, along these lines, generate a superpotential for all of the complex structure moduli of the Calabi-Yau. Okay, so all of these can gain mass. Okay. But what about this radius? Okay. And what KKLT pointed out is that in general there's no reason why this radius itself shouldn't get a superpotential from various sorts of effects. In some cases, instanton effects. In some cases, Gugino condensation. And so you might have a superpotential now which looks like this. W is W naught plus e to the minus rho over c, where rho is r to the fourth here plus ib. I've written it slightly differently than they do because I get confused. I put the i's in the wrong places if I'm not careful here. So the real part of rho is related to the radius of this complex space, this space. Okay. So this thing now has a supersymmetric minimum with rho of order minus log W naught. Okay, now what we want though, okay, so that's nice. Okay, so it now looks like we've now got a scheme in which all the moduli are fixed. Okay, but what we want is that this rho should be large. Okay, and that requires that W naught should be extremely small. Okay, so in the great majority of states, in other words, this rho is small, and so we can't really justify this analysis. Okay, but in some subset, we expect it will be large, okay, sort of according to the line of reasoning that Michael was describing yesterday, and that's what's required for self-consistency. Now, in fact, let's think through a moment what the sequence of approximations are that we're making here are. Okay, so basically, what the picture is that we started out with some compactification, so there's some Kaluza-Klein modes, okay, with masses of order 1 over r squared. Okay, we integrated out those first. Then we integrated out the complex structure moduli in the dilaton, okay, and then we integrated out this field rho. And if you think about the masses of these, the Kaluza-Klein masses are of order 1 over r squared. The masses of these complex structure moduli go through this, you find that they go like 1 over r cubed, but they also came because W naught involves the fluxes, these flux numbers, they also come with an n squared. And so what we need is, in order to justify this analysis, we need this sort of hierarchy of masses. Okay. So as I say, this requires that R, if you look here, this requires that R is large, okay, and rho is large, and then W, and as a result, W naught has to be exponentially small. Okay. So we need W naught, in fact, at least as small as e to the minus n squared. So I wrote approximately that this is really being very optimistic. Okay. So in other words, in only a tiny fraction of states, at best, is a self-consistent analysis possible. Okay, so this suggests some reasons for caution about the existence of the discrete rho. Okay, but the order of this talks was changed. So Douglas discussed the problem of counting in a more sophisticated way. Okay, but roughly, let me just explain sort of what you might expect.
Can you mind what n is?
N is the typical flux number. The capital M is the typical flux number. Okay, so again, think of this as 5 to 10 or so. Okay, and from this tadpole cancellation condition, one has n squared as of order this chi over 24. Okay, now as Michael stressed yesterday, okay, you could imagine the tadpole cancellation is really one condition on many numbers, but on the other hand, the argument we've just given says we probably can't let any given flux become extremely large if we're going to trust the analysis. So we can think of n squared as being of order chi squared over 24. Okay, we have B3 of these fluxes. And so if you just think of this, as Michael described, as a sort of sphere in this B3 dimensional space, and you ask about its volume, the number of states is then of order chi over 24. There were various four. Yes.
One of the B3 factorials.
Yeah.
I don't understand you.
I believe that's. It's not an artifact of the approximation. It's exactly the opposite limit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is the limit of large B3, of B3 large compared to chi over 24. Yeah. Where you want me to put it?
That's clear. But that's in the region.
Basically, the simplest.
I'll let Michael argue.
This is going to take too long.
Yeah. Maybe we should save this for the discussion. What I'm actually doing, I'm not going to defend this estimate. This is actually KKLT's estimate.
Yeah.
And I think it's not wildly off from what Michael describes.
Yeah.
But Michael can
stick to the rule that the long question should be left for the discussion.
This is anything that reduces the number of states. Okay, is a problem for this story. I'm actually writing down sort of an optimistic picture in which B3 is large. Okay, and if this estimate is correct, then there are enough states. Okay, in other limits, if you assume other limits, then you know if you go back to this. E to the minus n squared, okay, then you'll find that there may not be any states that you can analyze. Okay, and I'm trying to be what I want to call in this case conservative. In other words, I don't want to say the states or the things are ruled out if I can't reliably rule them out. So I want to take a point of view that favors the possible existence of this discrete term. You're welcome to take other points of view, but this discussion is interesting, and I think we should have it afterwards. Okay. Okay. So, as I said, as I was trying to say, though, in this case, if B3 is large compared to chi over 24, which is the opposite limit that Michael talked about, okay, then e to the minus n squared is much less than the number of states, and so there could still be many states in which a consistent analysis is possible. Okay. However, these estimates—the estimate I give in—is rather crude, and I think we just heard one reason. Okay, but also the estimates of the masses are rather crude. And in fact, if you look a little bit more detail at some toy models of this sort, you find that masses are often enhanced by other factors. They're enhanced by factors of tau, which by assumption is large for the consistency. In fact, typically by tau cubed. Okay, they are sometimes enhanced by B3 itself. Okay, if any of these factors are present, then it's not clear that any sort of self-consistent analysis is possible. Okay, now here's the one third of the talk that's going to come in just a minute. Okay, but another issue with all of these states, apart from this question of just whether the setup itself is simply self-consistent, is the question of whether really this sort of analysis makes sense. And Tom has been stressing for some time that solutions of a low-energy effective field theory don't necessarily correspond to solutions of some underlying quantum theory of gravity. And for example, in this context, I've jumped ahead a little bit and drawn something which is non-supersymmetric. But in this case, we're imagining states which are metastable. Okay, so really, the description of the system here is not a discrete, complete description of the quantum system. Okay, the quantum system has a past and a future, and we're focusing only on one small, albeit perhaps a very long-lived, but one small part of its history. And these other parts of the history we don't understand. Okay, we either tunnel out, perhaps into a big crunch in the future, or perhaps we started out with some sort of Big Bang singularity in the past. In any case, again, we don't have a system that we can analyze completely as a quantum system, even if there's some sort of self-consistent analysis of the system in terms of the effective Lagrangian for some fraction of its history in that minimum.
There certainly are pictures like that where you start out in that vacuum, then you tunnel out to something that just keeps expanding and you get a sensible cosmological
level. Right, but then you have to discuss the history which led you into this state to start with.
You started out in the metastable vacuum, and you've got to figure out how you got there.
Why don't you ask your question later in the discussion session?
Okay. So let me turn to supersymmetry breaking. Okay, so KKLT had a picture, which again we've heard about a little bit, involving anti-D3 brains. Adding anti-D3 brains to this picture, these can give exponentially small effects in the warp geometry, which breaks supersymmetry. I find this a little bit confusing to think about. I'm happier to think about the following. Let me just imagine, among these various theories, you know, there'll be, you can imagine there are all sorts of, and here of course I'm speculating because I don't, haven't surveyed this 10 to the 100 sorts of states, but you could well imagine, if certainly if we're imagining that we're going to be able to get gauge groups like the standard model and so on, that we'll get some theories with low energy dynamical supersymmetry breaking. Okay, that may be in a small fraction of the states, but remember if we're imagining this vast array of states, 10 to the 100 or 10 to the 200 or something of this sort, what's a factor of the billion between friends? Okay, so so in some fraction of states, you might imagine low energy dynamical supersymmetry breaking occurs. Okay, so there will be some sort of potential, which break corresponding to Suzy breaking, which behaves like some e to the minus 8 pi squared over b naught g squared, for example. Okay, and if g squared is distributed more or less uniformly, okay, and for this I don't have to be too uniform, then v will be distributed, these v's will be distributed roughly uniformly on a log scale. Okay, and the cosmological constant will be something like v is e to the minus 8 pi squared over b naught g squared minus 3 times w naught squared. Okay, so I want you to keep that in mind. We're going to come back to that. Okay, so at this point, okay, we have sort of tried to review a little bit for you the argument that there might be a vast array of states with the moduli stabilized with many ADS-based states, but also many with broken supersymmetry. Okay, and I've also given you some reasons why you might want, before you're convinced of that, you would like to think about this some more. But let me suppose for the moment that these states really exist and have roughly the properties we're imagining for them. And let me think about, and in that case, I think, well, in this I think I differ with Michael a bit, but I think that more or less would force us to think about some sort of anthropic view of things. And then, so there are many, many states, and low energy physics varies among them. Okay, so for example, the gauge groups are going to vary, the matter content, the values of the low energy parameters. Okay, and the picture is that maybe the universe somehow samples all of these states in some way in its history. And they're only observers, okay, with some, we can decide what we mean by observers, but in some subset with suitable properties. Where would this lead us? And the questions I want to ask are, can we rule out this particular implementation of the anthropic principle, or can we make predictions? Okay? Well, I think that the thing that has gotten us, led us to this kind of devil's bargain about the about the anthropic principle is the cosmological constant. This is the problem, of course, which, as Lisa said, we have really no good ideas about. Okay, and it's one that, you know, this coincidence of the cosmological constant and the value of the dark matter density today is the one thing that kind of troubles us and maybe makes us think that an anthropic explanation might make sense. And as Weinberg in particular said years ago, if you think about lambda, the cosmological constant, and you imagine all the other constants in nature fixed, then you can only form suitable structure if lambda is less than, well, he originally said about 100 times its observed value, and then thanks to various people, including Andre and Delenken and Weinberg again, retreated to the view that lambda might in fact be predicted to be within a factor of 10 or so of its observed value. Okay. So that's pretty impressive, and it's the really only argument that we have for that the cosmological constant should take the value that we seem to see. Now, already it's clear that this is there are some sort of funny business in this argument. For example, one's assumed in this that only one thing is fixed. And for example, if you allow other cosmological parameters to vary, okay, this limit can easily be relaxed by 7 or 8 orders of magnitude with no problem. And I think we'll hear from Savas even weaker restrictions on this quantity. Okay, but if we accept this for a moment, notice, by the way, that this leads us to something where we need a huge number of states. Okay, for example, even if we had supersymmetry and the breaking scale was as small as 10 to the 3 GeV, we would need, just to explain this question, we would need about 10 to the 60th states. Okay. Now, before talking about problems with this idea, let's ask whether we might get a prediction. So this is one thing I kind of like. Might the flux discretum predict low energy supersymmetry? Well, an EV or a fraction of an EV. Okay. So I have to suppose the anthropic argument for lambda, and I want to ask about the probability of small lambda without supersymmetry, and I'm not going to be as sophisticated as Michael yesterday, and I'll just say, well, you know what might I imagine? I might imagine that roughly this would go like the value of the observed cosmological constant over M Planck to the fourth. Now, first, to get small lambda with supersymmetry, that sounds like more like you need a small W naught. And in that case, you might imagine that the probability of getting a small W naught, and in fact, this agrees with one version of Michael's counting of yesterday, would be something like W naught, the value of W naught over MP cubed. And by this, I mean by this, the probability, this P is not the probability density, it's the probability of finding a W naught, a W less than W naught. Okay, so that says that there should certainly be more vacua, okay, with supersymmetry than without, as David says, of course. Let's see, I'm not going to repeat this estimate now since my time's going to ring out. As David says, of course, what it favors is to have the value of supersymmetry breaking, the scale of supersymmetry breaking, at 10 to the minus 3 eV or whatever number. Okay, so some very tiny number. Okay, and instead, okay, so if we're going to avoid that, we're going to have some more anthropic input. So we have to retreat a little bit. We can't just use the cosmological constant. And I'm not going to give an anthropic argument for MW, okay, but you could imagine, I'll leave that for Sabas this afternoon, okay, but you certainly could imagine that, for example, to have stars that live a reasonably long time and so on, that we need the W mass, for example, not to be so terribly small. And in that case, you might, and if we use those two inputs, we might make a guess about whether or not we might predict supersymmetry or not. And so here I've indicated sort of an estimate of the fraction of suitable states with these assumptions. So as I said, I gave myself a factor of 10 billion. These are just wild guesses, but just telling you how you might imagine things work. So I gave myself a factor of 10 billion, and again, Michael might tell us within a year or two what the real number is, but have some sort of suitable low-energy supersymmetry breaking. Okay, 10 to the minus 2, perhaps, because of this log scale, or maybe I should have said 10 to the minus 3, might have a supersymmetry breaking scale comparable to W naught. Okay, about 10 to the minus 13 have a suitable value of W naught, and 10 to the minus 60 of those, that's sort of this number I used before, have small enough lambda. Okay, so you need some combination of things, okay, in order to satisfy these two conditions. Okay, that's a big price to pay. Okay, this would be 10 to the minus 85, but for non-supersymmetric strings, we might imagine we need this 10 to the minus 120, which I mentioned before, and 10 to the minus 32 to get MW over MP. Okay, so supersymmetry wins, okay, if you like, unless there are an overwhelmingly large number of non-supersymmetric states. If my time's up, I'll leave it with the prediction of supersymmetry. Now notice that this picture favors supersymmetry breaking at the lowest possible scale, consistent with other anthropic arguments. Okay, so there's the real possibility here of some kind of prediction. I'm not making this prediction, obviously. Okay, so these numbers are sort of pulled out of the air. Okay, but you could imagine that with enough work, you could make a prediction of this kind. Okay, but before getting too excited, as I say, and I got very excited about this when I first thought about it. There are other issues to face in this flux discretum. So there are a number of things one needs to explain. One needs to explain the gauge group. One needs to explain the particle content. One needs to explain the couplings. And a nice way to organize this is in order of increasing scale. You really here want to think bottom up. Okay, so you want to use the language of effective actions in the renormalization group. And just let me just mention a few of the issues you're going to have to face. Okay. Well, some things that look plausibly anthropic. So you're going to have to explain why there's an unbroken U1. That you could certainly imagine is anthropic. SU3 is already a little bit harder. So if you can vary the U and D quark masses as you want, for example, you can reproduce a lot of nuclear physics with other gauge groups. Okay, so you probably have to look at rather detailed things like deuterium and so on. So purists who would like to just make structure are already going to get unhappy, but we're going
to
need... I believe so, though I had an argument with Ed about this question. But if you can explain to me what... But I want... I know. Any of them will give you bosonic nuclei and so on, nucleons. So 357 for now. My time's running out. We can. This is also for the discussion. Okay. ME over lambda QCD, that perhaps depends on things like molecular physics and so on. Okay. So again, we have to get more and more detail. Okay. But you could still imagine there are some sort of anthropic considerations for these things. MU, that should be lowercase MU, MD, things like proton stability, details of nuclear physics. Okay? But as we go up in energy, we're going to start to run into problems. Okay? So things like MS, MC, MB, the values of the KM angles, it's very hard to see how we're going to understand these anthropically. And as I say, Savas, I think, will talk about this, these issues at some length. Another interesting one is theta QCD. I think it's really hard to come up with an argument that theta QCD has to be terribly small. Okay, it has to be very small at all, in fact. Okay, and remember, by the way, well, in fact, let me explain why we're in trouble with the these various things. Okay, well, let me explain it here. So for theta QCD, you say, well, okay, we have an axion, but remember, we are one of the virtues of the flux discretum was it fixed all the moduli. Okay, so we really aren't going to have axions in general. And we'll come to some of the other problems that we have encounter in explaining these things as we go along. Okay, now it's still higher energies, we get into more trouble. We have to explain SU2 cross U1. Okay, and so again, you could imagine other weak gauge groups. And here, you need to work harder to think about anthropic arguments, which are going to explain, for example, why there aren't extra U1s or so on. If we have supersymmetry, we have to worry about proton decay. We have to worry about dark matter and eventually cosmological parameters and so on. Okay. Now, what I like to say about these is all the quantities which are not readily anthropically explained, okay, have to have some rational explanation. If they're simply random numbers, okay, they're not going to emerge. These quantities are not going to emerge with their correct values, okay, in this picture, okay. So, as I say, for example, for proton decay, okay, we expect anthropically a limit of about 10 to the 16th years, okay. But so we might try and explain this by symmetries, but most states of the flux discretum don't have symmetries. And I think I won't do any counting here, but you can already do in your head, you can say, well, if you think about examples you know, like the quintic in CP4, okay, that has can have a big discrete symmetry, but the fluxes you would write down almost all break some of those symmetries. Okay, and so if you want to, so you have this very large dimensional space, but it's cut very rapidly, okay, as you make more and more requirements. Okay, so in fact, as you go down this list, okay, there are going to be a whole set of problems that you have to deal with. Okay, and so the bad news is that I think if you think about the flux discretum, it doesn't look like it will make correct predictions for many quantities. Okay, the good news is if you really are convinced that it's there. There are lots of things that we still have to explain that require some rational explanation, okay, and simply aren't going to be waved away by the anthropic principle. So let me conclude by saying that I think flux vacua are not implausible, okay, and I say they're rather, as I said at the beginning, they're rather frightening, but they're hardly established. Okay. There are both fundamental conceptual difficulties of the sort that I talked about before, these kind of questions of whether or not this kind of analysis is really revealing large number of states of a real quantum theory, and as well as more technical ones, just even within the assumptions that are being made for the analysis of this effective Lagrangian. Okay. And then there's the question of these anthropics. Anthropic constraints are almost certainly not enough to fix all the values of the couplings that vary in the flux discretum, okay, to their observed value. So they'll come out wrong. Okay, and so if this picture were to be correct, rational explanations are required, and they're not at least immediately apparent. Okay, though I still find this prediction of low-energy supersymmetry breaking intriguing. Okay, So as for as Lisa and David have said, giving up the anthropic principle may amount to giving up, but I think if we establish this flux discrete theorem, we have no choice but to face these issues. Okay, but I have not yet given up, and I like to think there may be an alternative. There will be an alternative viewpoint or set of principles. Okay, and the fact that we don't really understand any interesting, i.e., non-supersymmetric state of string theory, may be an indication that we still have some ways to go before we have to despair. Okay, so I'll quit there.
For keeping on time.
So the argument that theta QCD doesn't look like it's been chosen by a random or anthropic selection is a sharp one, and it's useful for trying to sharpen this picture. I'd like to propose a way it could emerge from the discrete theorem. Suppose the number of vacua as a function of theta is 100 plus 10 to the following power, 100 plus 20 cosine theta. That's just, okay. Smooth function even in theta. That's pretty much what it's got to be. With 10 to that power, almost all the vacua have theta near zero. So this is a new solution to the strong CP problem.
Your boss is making faces, but I think it sounds pretty good. I have no comment. That's very close. You know, I can only that I can count on Joe to say something more ingenious than anything I thought of while preparing this talk.
Okay, my question is about discrete versus continuum. Because for cosmologists, discretum is like a set of different de Sitter or anti-de Sitter states. And continuum, the analogy of this is almost de Sitter or anti-de Sitter states, like, for example, inflation or dark energy with slowly changing equation of state. So I think that Vilenkin will be talking about anthropic principle using this continuum. Therefore, it would be really important to understand why, and really should we be very pessimistic with this respect, because it really helps us a lot to use anthropic principle. And now my question would be the following. A few years ago, we would think that even getting de Sitter very difficult in string theory. Now we're happy that maybe it's not that difficult. Okay. Now, if we want to have continuum, this means that we want to have something like inflation, something like dark energy. If we do not get inflation, I think we will probably be in a bad shape.
No.
Yes.
Okay. The question is getting long enough, maybe we should break it into some parts.
My long question with a question like that. SNAP satellite will fly, and they will find out what is the equation of state of dark energy. If equation of state of dark energy will not be exactly W equal to minus one, like for cosmological constant, this would mean that continuum is very, very well into the game. And would you at this stage say that this rules out string theory, or rules out some of your assumptions? So what would be your statement at that stage?
Let me try, you know, there are lots of pieces to this question. First of all, as far as ordinary inflation doesn't require a field with quite as extraordinary properties as is required for quintessence. I mean, basically, as we kind of were hearing yesterday, I mean, a generic potential that you might write in, you know, for moduli, for example, you know, basically just gets things wrong. It just requires a factor, a fine tuning of a part in 100 or something, and everything is okay. So this is a little different. Now, the first thing I would like, I would turn this around, and I would say I would like to establish, and I don't have such a thing, a theorem. You know, just like we think about the question of whether there's a shortest length in string theory. Okay, is there a theorem that says that the decay constants of these axions are strictly bounded by m Planck over square root of 3 or something? We certainly don't have anything like that. What the exercise we did was we surveyed a lot of examples. Okay, maybe before the talk is over, Joe will tell me the answer to this too. And you could well imagine that there's a theorem, and if there's not a theorem with enough work, one will find a counterexample. So, I think I will be totally shocked if W isn't equal to minus one. The evidence is already kind of growing that W is pretty close to minus one. Being shocked is good. I'm shocked that there's a cosmological constant at all. So, you know, it's shocking, and it will mean, you know, the cosmological constant already says, especially certainly if these anthropic ideas aren't right, the cosmological constant certainly says that there's something really seriously missing in the way we think about physics. And if quintessence is verified, then that we have that in spades.
So I wanted to better understand the precise objection to this picture where you start out in the metastable minimum and tunnel out. Now, of course, that's true. You can't be in there for infinite time. There's a whole region of that diagram, so to speak, we don't understand, the left, and one would expect string theory to provide some kind of boundary conditions there. We don't know what they are. So what, in principle, is wrong with... So
it's really convenient to have your collaborator in the audience to say something intelligent about this question.
And I don't see how we can say that there's an objection to that. But,
I mean, I could take that, but I think yeah. Tom is really the one who has taught me what I think.
I think that the real issue is a quantum system is defined in some kind of a stable state. And the metastable state is an excitation of that. Now, you can get some guess as to what the stable state consists of by looking at what the metastable state decays into. The metastable state decays into this cosmological solution, which, if I take it and extrapolate it back into the past as a classical solution, has a Big Bang singularity. Okay? And so that says that a priori you don't have a complete description of this system that stays within the bounds of effective field theory. If you don't have a complete description that stays within the bounds of effective field theory, then I think that makes the effective field theory analysis incomplete and suspicious. Now there are more fundamental objections that I have to the way in which we tend to use effective field theory, and I could discuss those at some length, but that would be a talk rather than an answer to a question. But I'm just saying that just on the basis of what we know about these states, effective field theory is not a complete description of the physics. Therefore, the fact that they exist in effective field theory is not a proof that they exist in string theory.
I think part of the point of this is not really an objection per se. I mean, it's not a statement. I don't think any of us can tell you. Tom would be more forceful than I, but I don't think we could tell you that this is an objection to the discretum per se. But it is a statement that the discretum, part of the story that the discretum is not really established, because you don't have a complete description by any means of this set of states.
Perhaps you continue this if you have two more questions.
So as far as the existence of the discretum, in the ADS case, we have another tool, which is ADS-CFT. And we know about discretum of conformal field theories that are completely under control at weak field theory coupling. And we can also, there's agreement for the entropy even in these highly tuned examples with small curvature.
So for the non-supersymmetric states, I agree with you. For the non-supersymmetric states, I'm sorry, for the supersymmetric states, which are ADS, you could imagine that, for example, that you will find CFT duals to them. The question is going to be, but there's an added part to this, which is whether they look at all like four-dimensional field theories with the kind of properties that we're imputing to them. If the analysis isn't self-consistent, that won't establish that the states don't exist. Okay, but it raises a question of whether they look like the sorts of things that we're claiming they look like.
Okay, and sorry, one more quick thing. I find your argument about supersymmetry interesting, but of course the deck is a little bit stacked in its favor if you just start with the models like KKLT, which are the ones which have a low energy supersymmetric effective field theory description. There are other starting points which are as under control, but don't. And I think you have to keep those in mind if you
No, there's a basic assumption here. The deck was definitely stacked. And this comes from, well, The first statement was, though, that of course the deck had better be wildly in favor for non-supersymmetric theories to exist. There has to be an overwhelming preponderance of sort of non-supersymmetric starting points for this discussion. And for example, Michael yesterday talked about counting of non-supersymmetric solutions and didn't find, if I understood correctly, any such overwhelming preponderance. Let me finish because this is, as I said, a lot of this talk is opinion rather than fact. But if we think about, I don't know how to think about this in a general way, but let me just think about, for example, Calabi-Yau spaces. Okay, so I could think about supersymmetric strings on Calabi-Yau and compactifications of non-supersymmetric strings. And you might imagine that supersymmetry is somehow special, so that, for example, there might be many more non-supersymmetric, not even non-supersymmetric strings, just generally, many more non-supersymmetric compactifications of string theory than supersymmetric ones. On the other hand, if we just ask about the existence of classical solutions, we know that supersymmetry plays an important role in guaranteeing the existence of solutions. And so you might imagine, so I have a prejudice, which is sort of that why should the number of non-supersymmetric states be overwhelmingly larger than the number of supersymmetric ones?
Well,
I think our time is.
We should give just Raphael the chance to pose.
I also want to close with one comment, so I want to save 2 seconds for a comment.
Okay, Raphael, quickly, because time
is. I just had a quick comment on what Andre said. If it turns out that we have quintessence. Quintessence does not explain why the cosmological constant is so small. Quintessence does not explain why the cosmological constant is so small. So even if you have quintessence, you will still need to explain why.
We should probably save this. Andre has a discussion session after his talk, I think.
Go on in private. You wanted to make.
I meant to make one comment just because I was taken aback by Joe's comment. I would say that if Joe or Eva or Sandeep or someone exhibits a discretum which favors such values of theta, I think that would definitely give pause.
Okay. Thank you very much again. Next talk.